Welcome, everyone. You're tuning in to the Beyond the Pulse podcast, brought to you by the expert doctors at My Cardiologist, where we discuss a wide range of topics related to cardiovascular wellness and provide you with the knowledge, motivation, tips, and tools to help you make informed choices about your heart health. My Cardiologist is proud to be a leading provider of comprehensive cardiovascular care, serving the South Florida community for over 60 years. And we're thrilled to extend our care beyond the clinic through this podcast. Thank you for joining us.
Good morning. My name is Dr. David Mischkel, and I am an interventional and general cardiologist. I was trained in Canada at McMaster University in Hamilton, Ontario, as well as University of Toronto, where I did my first fellowship in interventional cardiology. That's putting in coronary stents. And then I moved down to Houston to Herman Hospital. I did a second year of interventional cardiology. And then I moved to Pensacola, Florida, where I was in private practice for 5 years. And then I opened up my practice in 1999 in Boca Raton, and I've been a part of My Cardiologist for the last 2 years now.
Hi, my name is Tamara Mischkel. I'm a physician associate with My Cardiologist, and I'm here today with my husband, Dr. David Mischkel. And today we're going to be discussing pediatric cardiology as well as adult and geriatrics cardiology. So very interesting topics. Hope you enjoy it. So the first question is, what are the key factors that contribute to heart health in childhood?
Well, I think some of the key factors are relevant not only to pediatrics, but of course, adult cardiology. So when we talk about certain lifestyle issues with nutrition and diet, physical activity, it's relevant throughout the ages. Hypertension, diabetes, any chronic diseases can also play a part in pediatric cardiology. And we can talk further as well about things like obesity and screen time, how much time children spending on their phones.
Mm-hmm. How does pediatric cardiology differ from adult cardiology?
Well, those kids are different. They're almost a different species, and they really require an element of specialization. I know you've told me you would not take a Mini Cooper into a Hyundai shop. You want to go to a doctor who really is trained with these specific diseases that we see in the childhood years that may not pertain so much to the adult years. So one is, I think you have to choose your specialist or your doctor quite well. And specialization is necessary because there are some disease processes that really are unique to the pediatric population. Certain viral illnesses that we see in children and not in adults. Certain autoimmune illnesses such as Kawasaki disease that can also affect the heart we do not see in adults. And then, of course, the very highly specialized congenital cardiac issues that manifest as an infant or as a child that we will see later on in life as these children grow up, but they require specialty or subspecialty care from the get-go.
What are common heart conditions in children, and how are they diagnosed and treated?
So I liken the heart to housing construction. When you build a home, you have to deal with the wiring, and the heart has electrical fibers. You have to deal with the piping, and the heart has coronary arteries. You have to deal with the fascia or the drywall, and the heart has muscle and other ligamentous structures. There's the roof or the casing, and the heart has a pericardium. And you have internal features like valves that also can be affected pathologically. So in children and in adults, disease processes can affect all those different structures. In the coronary arteries, of course, in adults, it tends to be atherosclerotic heart disease, a degenerative process. But in children, disease would manifest with congenital malocation of those arteries. They were put in the wrong place. Flow may be interrupted due to anatomic issues. So quite different causes, different manifestations, presentations, symptoms, etc. You know, we talk about inflammation affecting the heart. It can affect the heart muscle as an adult or as a child. Inflammation can affect the sac of the heart called the pericardium, giving pericarditis, and it happens both in adulthood and childhood. So we have a whole array of diagnostic imaging modalities, both for adults and children, In children, we want to try and not undergo ionizing radiation. Mm-hmm. So using more ultrasound or MRI as opposed to CT. But of course, when it's necessary and when it's for the benefit of the patient, you know, X-ray with CT is used. Going back to what makes pediatric cardiology so specialized is the arena of the congenital heart defects. So this is where you may have heard of somebody being born with a hole in the heart. And that actually is really one of the most common issues, a ventricular septal defect. They're born with a murmur that may be detected in the, you know, in the birth room or in the recovery room. And these holes in the heart may close up spontaneously. So that is diagnosed often with plain old stethoscope in one's ears. Other common, you know, birth defects would be a bicuspid aortic valve. That's where the valve, instead of having three leaflets, has two leaflets. Something called coarctation of the aorta or narrowing of the aorta. Patent ductus arteriosus, a complex kind of physiologic plumbing issue with children. And many other more rare congenital defects that can be diagnosed, as mentioned, and then treated, oftentimes percutaneously, but sometimes too surgically. And it may not be just one surgery. What's special to children is they're still growing, and the surgery needs to grow with them. So they may be coming back for repeated surgeries, and they need to be followed throughout their pediatric years by a pediatric specialist, and then graduate to an adult cardiology specialist dedicated to congenital heart disease.
Very interesting. How do childhood habits such as diet and physical activity influence heart health in later years?
Well, I know that you are a new mother, so I thought that I might hand this over to you. Why don't you give me your thoughts on this topic?
So as children grow and develop, it's really important for them to have a balanced diet, to have nutritious food. So that means really reduce processed foods, try to have things that are fresh. So that means cooking at home, preparing meals. I know a lot of parents are very pressured with time. So meal prepping is a great way to save time, and also it saves money along the line. And it's really important as a parent to also lead through example by doing healthy things. Parents are going to have the children also see that and want to do the same thing.
They're the great imitators, aren't they?
Exactly. So another thing too is you're also preparing their taste buds early on to be accustomed to healthy foods. I know it can be a mission to get them to eat healthy things, but you just keep on trying and make it fun. Maybe cut the food in fun shapes, get them excited, make it a family activity, because that way they also are doing something with their parents and it excites them and they look forward to it. And you're also spending time together as a family, so it's really good for mental health and development. So those are my suggestions.
Great suggestions. Love them all. I think it's important to spend a lot of time outside, to participate in outdoor activities. I think of my generation, we remember growing up and just playing outside. That's a little bit less common now. Going to the park, not spending time on screen. I think you and I share the opinion that too much screen time just is not advantageous. And social media can be useful, but, you know, of course, can be harmful.
Everything in moderation. And another thing I wanted to add is it's important to not eat in front of the TV, because there is evidence that you're not really aware of your food intake. It's kind of like mindless eating. So you're not giving time to your body to listen to those cues of satiety. So it's really important to not have the television in front of them while they're eating. I know this is easier said than done. I'm not saying it has to be always a case, but try as much as you can to really not eat in front of the television.
And I think you and I are both fans of participation in school sports and after school activities and intramurals and all those things.
Great. And they also build great social skills. It's good for mental health as well. I really think mental health is also very important in early development. What role do genetics play in pediatric heart health?
Well, there are some very definite genetic malformations that are very important. So probably one of the most common ones is a syndrome called familial hyperlipidemia. So I'm not sure of the exact number. It is not a very rare. It may be as much as 1 in 200. There is what we call heterozygous and homozygous. So heterozygous is where they have one abnormal gene, homozygous two. And the homozygous is more severe with cholesterols that may be as high as 600. Heterozygous, perhaps cholesterols in the 300 range. So a lifetime of cholesterol that high really damages the inner lining of the coronary arteries. And we see breakdown and degeneration starting teens and 20s, especially with the familial hyperlipidemia form. So those homozygous people really can suffer an untimely death in the 20s or 30s, whereas the other may be in the 40s or 50s. So as a genetic screen, I think it really is important for all children at some point, whether it's age 9, 11, teens, or 20s, to have this cholesterol screen to rule out that very, very high form. Because we have very good data that if these children are targeted early, we can help prevent premature onset of vascular disease. It's a preventable death. Now, there are other things where we don't have treatments. There's Ehlers-Danlos, there's Marfan's, Holt-Oram syndrome, even Down syndrome is associated with premature coronary disease. So it's important to have access to a geneticist, and I'm very happy to say that we at My Cardiologists have access to a medical geneticist who does a great job to identify these children's and look and see what cardiac issues they're at risk for. Just by historical note, Marfan syndrome is what Abe Lincoln had. It's where you're very tall, long limbs, and you're at risk of an aortic aneurysm and dissection, which is a preventable, you know, a tragic death.
Mm-hmm. What preventative measures can parents take to ensure good heart health for their children?
So kind of expanding on what you brought up, I think leading by example with healthy behaviors, let's not forget dental care. I think dental hygiene can lead to, you know, inflammation and likely coronary disease. Keep your pediatric appointments. It really is important to see your pediatrician regularly. You want to maintain your ideal body weight. And then as we start moving to adolescence or later years, you want to talk about those more uncomfortable and difficult topics like alcohol, smoking, marijuana, vaping. I think teens have a sense of immortality and they really don't think that something like vaping is bad. But I don't think any of us would want to go out and choose to suck on our tailpipe. And I don't think we would want to inhale a combustible that we find in vaping. So I know we're lacking a little bit in strong data that vaping is bad for you, but we should not accept it as a kinder form and less problematic than smoking. I think any of that is just a bad precedent to start taking up. So parents, talk to your children about it. Keep open lines of communication. Look on their phone. That may be a little bit contentious issue, but I think that's good to know what's going on in your child's life. And you should have access to it because you're the parent.
Exactly. How important is regular checkup and monitoring in pediatric heart care?
Well, I see my doctor every year, and even though health issues arise much less frequently in children, I think it is important to be seen at least once a year, make sure all the milestones are being met, make sure that, you know, intermittent testing and screening be done. So I can't emphasize enough. I just feel important, regular, ongoing care.
Now we're moving into young adulthood. So what heart health considerations should young adults be aware of as they transition from adolescence?
I hate to sound like a broken record, but exercise is a really good thing. I think it needs to be part of our daily hygiene. We floss our teeth every day, I hope. We should not want to go to bed without having exercised, you know, that day. And take a couple days off is fine. But I think that's a really healthy habit. It can be play as you're a child and then, you know, organize sports. But I've always wanted my kids in their teens and 20s to continue on. And I hope that my exercise would kind of spawn them to want to exercise in their own lives as well. And I think that is generally true.
So as you become an adult, how do you find that time to incorporate physical activity?
Sure. So life is busy and being a parent is very busy. I turn to the phone and there is a great app that you can download called 7-Minute Workout. So it's a wonderful combination of both aerobic and strength training. And like it says, it's 7 minutes. You mentioned there's a lot of free YouTube videos out there. Try and get some time at lunch hour. Try and park far away in the parking lot. Try and do the stairs whenever you can. I tell my patients, try and do it first thing in the morning because it's just so difficult at the end of the day to find the time and energy to exercise. So if you can wake up a little bit earlier and get it done before you leave the door, I think that's kind of the best way to do it.
And another thing I wanted to add, if you have a desk job, make sure you take breaks. If it's 30 minutes to 45 minutes that you've been sitting, be mindful. Okay, I need to walk for a few minutes, increase your physical activity, even just by walking in between your work hours.
Right. Do some push-ups at work.
Yeah.
Close the door and do it in private.
How does cardiovascular exercise contribute to heart health in young adults?
Well, I think the main thing is that you do want to set these life habits, that it's, if you go into adulthood at an unhealthy weight, it just gets harder each year to shed that weight and add on development of orthopedic issues, a bad knee, a bad shoulder. It just adds insult to injury. So try and go into your 20s and 30s at a lean weight. We have a lot of good data that both aerobic and strength training actually reduce morbidity and mortality. So I tell my patients that the guidelines from 2018 are 5 days of 30 minutes of aerobic exercise. So just walking 30 minutes, 5 days a week is excellent. We have a lot of strong data that reduces inflammation, cardiac morbidity, and mortality. The really striking thing is throwing 2 days of resistance or weight reduces total mortality. I was very surprised to read that it even reduces cancer deaths. So likely weightlifting, whether it's the mental benefits, reducing the stress hormones, reducing inflammation, reduces cardiac and cancer and total mortality. So these are strong things that we can do for ourselves. Cheapest prescription I can ever write for a patient.
Okay.
I just wanted to add that this had a financial impact on my life. So I was quite surprised when I was applying for life insurance that I went to my phone and showed the insurance agent the fact that I had done a half marathon, and they gave a discount based on how well you place for the marathon. So it's obvious to me that actuaries know that the greater your fitness level, the longer you're going to live and the cheaper your life insurance will be. That's a powerful message.
All right, so now we've moved on to adulthood. What are some prevalent heart conditions in adults and how can they be prevented?
Well, I think probably the greatest frequency condition is that of coronary atherosclerosis. So I think we all know about the role that lipids and cholesterol can play, along with hypertension, diabetes, smoking, obesity, and activity, et cetera. So from a medical drug point of view, we want to target LDL cholesterol and lower that. There's a new kid on the block, and it's quite interesting, and that has to deal with inflammation. So it was observed that there are a lot of patients having heart attacks who didn't suffer from high cholesterol. Cholesterol wasn't explaining it all to all people. And there was a cardiologist named Paul Ritker who took upon this hypothesis, and he looked at a blood test called C-reactive protein, high-sensitivity cardiac C-reactive protein, and he noted that if you had a value of 2 or higher, independent of your LDL level, be it high or low, that was a very strong risk factor for developing coronary disease. And then he took it further, as well as other investigators, and there has been a trial of 2 trials totaling about 10,000 patients looking at an anti-inflammatory medication called colchicine. Now, this drug has not been available for decades. It's been available for eons. So it is derived from the autumn crocus, fun fact, and this was known to the Greeks and the Egyptians. So this has been around for a long time as an anti-inflammatory. So given to a total of 10,000 patients with coronary disease, and it significantly reduced cardiac morbidity and mortality as much as a lot of our more basic therapies out there. And if you treated about 35 patients, you would prevent a cardiac event similar to our other efficacy of our other cardiac medications. So really a very strong medication. It doesn't interact adversely with our other cardiac medications. It tends to be very well tolerated at this low dose of 0.5 milligrams per hour. At higher doses, it can cause diarrhea. It should not be given to patients with chronic kidney or liver disease. So I'm starting to discuss with my patients whether you have inflammation or don't, whether your CRP is elevated or not, because the trials did not require that to get into the trial. If you want to do everything you absolutely can do, if you've got aggressive coronary disease, if you've got premature early coronary disease, then I think you should talk to your doctor about adding colchicine onto your regimen.
Very interesting new data. How does stress impact heart health in adulthood?
Well, I think that that just ties into what we talked about, that really stress is pro-inflammatory and inflammation is bad. We think inflammation can lead to coronary disease, to cancer, a whole slew of things. We know that, you know, type A individuals who are under high stress have a greater risk for developing coronary disease. So I think it really is a bad boy, and likely we're becoming more open to mental health issues and dealing with stress and apps on your phone and meditation and other things. So it's an important player.
Exactly. How does nutrition play a role in maintaining heart health?
You know, back in the 1960s, when it wasn't really known that cholesterol was put you at risk for coronary disease, they studied populations. They looked at Eskimos and they looked at the Japanese, who had a very high, healthy fish diet, and they had a very low incidence of coronary disease. Interestingly, when Japanese migrated to the U.S. and developed all the bad eating habits of Americans, that's when they came down with coronary disease. So diet really is key. It's one of the pillars that we need to pay attention to in helping prevent coronary artery disease.
I couldn't agree more. Are there specific diets recommended for heart health in adulthood?
Well, let me put that back to you. What do you think is the ideal diet?
The Mediterranean diet.
The Mediterranean diet. I think you and I both share the thought that we're all different genetically. And I know people are asked, what is the best diet? And I don't know that there's one best diet or intermittent fasting or South Beach. I think we all respond differently to nutrition, and some do better with one versus another. So I think in concert with your diet and in concert with having your lipids, blood fats checked and other things checked, you will live and learn as to what works best for you. But there's a lot of data for the Mediterranean diet. That's why we both believe in that diet.
Right. Now we're moving on to geriatric cardiology. How does cardiology care change as individuals age?
So as we age, we start to lose muscle mass. We start to lose enzyme function. The kidneys and the liver are less adept at metabolizing medications. So I think we have to be conscious of lowering doses, perhaps, of the medicines. Mm-hmm. Be aware of drug-drug interactions. We're different as we age.
What are some common cardiovascular issues in the elderly?
One very common issue in my practice is that of postural hypotension. So that means low blood pressure when we stand up, and it can result in fainting. There are a lot of different causes of it. It can be very prevalent in diabetics who may lose some nervous function in what we call the autonomic nervous system. It can happen with various neurologic conditions like Parkinson's, where they're no longer so adept at managing their blood pressure, going from a lying to standing position. Certainly certain medications can do it, diuretics, certain blood pressure medications. So it really is a very prevalent problem. And unfortunately, as we age and we become less active and more bedbound, one of the major derivatives of how, or determinants of how blood returns to the heart, is our calf muscles. So when we're sitting, all the blood flushes down or seeps down to our calves, and we suddenly stand up, but all the blood is down there by the floor. Mm-hmm. So I teach my patients to learn how to pump their feet, do toe raises, grip their hands. Drinking ice water very quickly elicits what's called a cold pressor response that elevates the blood pressure. And this is a way to prevent those faints or falls, perhaps as you get up from a lovely, you know, dinner meal with a little bit of wine and sitting down for 2 hours. So that's a common thing, and we have to struggle to maintain our activity level, keep our calf muscles strong to help promote the venous circulation, return of blood flow to the heart.
Would you also recommend compression socks? How do you feel about that?
Absolutely. That is a good way to prevent blood from seeping out of the circulation. By compressing those veins, that improves venous return. Thank you.
How do individuals manage chronic heart conditions in their later years?
Well, I think it takes a village. I think it takes having a great cardiology team, and I think we offer that at My Cardiologists. We've got PAs, we've got nurse practitioners, access to do dietitians and nutritionists. We've got great contact with the primary care doctor to close the loop and make sure that there is excellent communication between primary and specialty care. I think technology can be helpful. And at My Cardiologist, we've got access to that with remote patient monitoring through the use of blood pressure monitors that they take at home. Mm-hmm. And as soon as they check their blood pressure, it goes to the cloud and comes to our office. We get alerts if there's a problem. We call them monthly to go over their medicines and their blood pressure control. There's also implantable monitors under the skin to monitor the heartbeat should they be having symptoms or arrhythmias like atrial fibrillation. Of course, too, there's wearable devices. Obviously, you know, I'm wearing an Apple Watch, and we've all heard of those stories of the wearables that can, you know, detect arrhythmias. So I think these are all very helpful in how technology is helping shape the way we can better care for our patients.
What role does medication play in geriatrics cardiology?
Well, it can be both a blessing and it can be a curse. We look at both efficacy of medications, but also toxicity and side effects. And let's not forget potential medication errors. So we make it, we strive to bring patients into the office within a week or two of discharge from hospital to review their medications, because invariably they're changed from admission to discharge. They've got one set of pills at home and they're given another set and they don't know the difference, and the nurse was too rushed to go over it with them. So many medication errors can be prevented because there really can be harmful effects. So we just have to be aware of how we prescribe medications to issues like drug cost, ease of administration, who's giving the medicines, do they need a caregiver to oversee administration, memory issues, compliance issues. I don't know anybody who's really signed up that wants to come into the office and say, "Doc, I'd like to get more medications, more pills, please."
Right. That's really, really important. What are some considerations for end-of-life care in the context of heart conditions?
Well, I think a big issue that many cardiologists may not feel is in their, you know, tool shed is really dealing with falls. I think falls is a bit of a pandemic in the United States as our population ages. 3 million adults are treated in the emergency room with falls, and it's the leading cause of injury and death in those greater than 65. So it's a very big public health concern, and we really have to do everything we can to try and mitigate that. So the things that I advise for my patients is, of course, exercise. It builds strength. It builds our reflexes. Sometimes I'll ask my patient, if I put you on the floor here, would you be able to get up? Can you get up from a chair without pushing down with your arms? If you're losing strength, you're prone to falls. And often a fall is a sign of a deterioration. I think we've all seen that in our own parents. It's kind of the slippery slope of how things go downhill. So tell your mom or your dad, use the cane, use the walker. If you're not able to exercise, get up slowly. You know, do the toe lifts before you get up. How to minimize the bad effects. I mean, do they have a life alert? How are they going to call for help? God forbid they're found 2 days later, you know, still on the floor. I saw an interesting article that in Scandinavia, they are teaching judo to elderlies because judo is the art of the break fall. How do you fall without hurting yourself? So they actually go around to seniors' homes and help teach people how to fall more, you know, harmlessly. So lots of things we can do to help, to be aware of it, to screen for it, and to try and help our patients.
Recently also you recommended Tai Chi that you heard from a patient that has really helped him. And how about physical therapy for those that have access to it?
Absolutely. You know, the CDC recommends Tai Chi because it improves balance. Thank you for reminding me. So I'm always looking for programs available to our patients in Boca Raton.
What advice would you give to individuals of all ages for maintaining heart health across the lifespan?
Well, a little bit tongue-in-cheek, I would say strive to find your six-pack. I think that is the sign of your best health, when you've got a minimal amount of central obesity, then your insulin levels are low, your triglyceride levels are low, your HDL or protective cholesterol is at its highest, your blood pressure is at its lowest and healthiest. So minimizing central body fat is really quite key.
Any final thoughts on the importance of heart health awareness at every stage of life?
I like the saying that life is a marathon and not a race. So as the Stoics said in ancient Greece, everything in moderation. Don't have diet swings, huge swings in your weight, in your lifestyle. Slow and steady wins the race. So everything in moderation.
Yes, Dr. Mishkal, thank you so much for your time today. I hope everyone enjoyed and take care.
Thank you, Tamara. It's wonderful talking with you.
Likewise.
Thank you for tuning in. And make sure you hit subscribe if you haven't already. To learn more about My Cardiologist, please visit us at mycardiologist.com.